From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The investigative reporter Michael Moss says if there's one thing to learn from his new book about the processed food industry, it's that there's nothing accidental in the grocery store. The canned music, the aromas from the bakery, and of course the food itself, it's all calculated, engineered. Charts and regression analyses. Moss says there's even an equation, a mathematical equation for the ideal snack. The problem, of course, is health and nutrition isn't really part of that equation. These massive food giants are looking for just the right amount of sugar or fat or salt that will hook you. Today in the program, Michael Moss will join us to talk about his book, which investigates the science and scheming going on among food companies to distort the American diet. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his new book, the investigative reporter Michael Moss explores the processed food industry, a massive enterprise that accounts for $1 trillion a year in sales. But you have to put another number alongside that one, the $300 billion a year or so that the epidemic of obesity is costing us. Moss says the makers of processed food argue they have allowed us all to become the people we want to be, fast and busy and no longer slaves to the stove. But along the way, he says they have used salt and sugar and fat to propel this transformation. Pretty much everything about the experience of going to your typical grocery store is calculated and processed and engineered. The food giants, he says, are looking for the precise amount of sugar or fat or salt that will hook you. For sugar, they're looking for a bliss point. For fat, they're going for mouthfeel. For salt, they want a flavor burst. Michael Moss is joining us today to talk about his book. It's called Salt, Sugar, Fat: How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Michael Moss is an investigative reporter for the New York Times. He won a Pulitzer Prize in 2010 for explanatory reporting for his investigation of the dangers of contaminated meat. And he's joining us today from a studio in New York City. Michael Moss, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. And thank you so much for that careful reading of the book. I can tell you, you did read it.
Well, I want to start with actually spend a good amount of time with this story that you tell right at the beginning of the book that really kind of frames the issue and gives the scope of what you're really talking about. It's a meeting that takes place in Minneapolis. It's the corporate headquarters of Pillsbury. This is April 8th, 1999. And as you say it in the book, 11 leaders of the country's largest food companies have gathered there, which you explain in the book really kind of charted a course for the industry for the years to come. Talk about this meeting. Then start with James Bankey, if you would. He's this official with Pillsbury. He and a couple of others have sort of put together this this plan to make this presentation to these big leaders. Did I set that up okay?
Yes. No. Absolutely. And I love talking about this meeting because it I discovered it early on in my research and writing for this book, which was really like being inside a detective story. James Bankey was a longtime chief technology officer for Pillsbury. He and a number of other insiders at that company and others had become increasingly concerned about the emerging obesity epidemic, particularly as it pertained to kids. He was talking to nutrition scientists, people affiliated with the processed food industry but not inside it, who were presenting some damning evidence linking their foods to not just obesity but to diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, even the surging amount of gout. And he got together a few other insiders to present the notion to these CEOs that their industry was perhaps at least partly responsible for this obesity crisis. And one of the more extraordinary things, and this whole meeting was extraordinary because, you know, these CEOs and presidents of these companies normally are at each other's throats. It can't be overstated how much fierce competition there is. You know, you walk into the grocery store and it seems like this tranquil place and the soft music is playing and everything is neatly ordered. But behind the scenes, these food giants are fighting tooth and nail against each other for space on the grocery shelf and what they call stomach share, space in your stomach. But the people who organized this meeting were able to bring these CEOs together to sit down calmly with each other for this rare event. And up before them got none other than one of their own, a senior executive of Kraft named Michael Mudd.
Right.
And Michael Mudd is armed with 114 slides, you know, with which he basically, feeling even more strongly about this than James Behnke, with which he lays at their feet responsibility not only for the obesity and diabetes, as I mentioned, but he also begins linking their products, the processed food industry generally with several cancers. And then he says to them, look, even if you don't accept responsibility for this emerging and soon to grow crisis health epidemic, you know, the lawyers who went after big tobacco will find you responsible and will eventually come after you. And Michael Mudd pleaded with them, the CEOs, to collectively do something to turn a corner on behalf of consumers. Mm. And collectively was a real key point here, because he knew that they were so fiercely competitive with each other that if any one of them tried to do the right thing in dialing back the nutritional loads of their products, the others would swoop in and claim that space on the grocery shelf. So he was pleading for a collective action on the part of the industry. And as your listeners might guess from his perspective, from Michael Mudd's perspective, the meeting was an utter failure. The CEOs reacted.
Hold on. I want to back up, because the way you tell this is so great in the book. And I'm trying to imagine Michael Moss now. Michael Mudd finishes this presentation. It's highly choreographed, very scripted. James Behnke, Michael Mudd, a number of these guys are figuring, all right, we're going to – surely they're a little worried about how people are going to react. And they come up with these proposals that sounded kind of radical. You know, pull back on the use of salt, sugar, and fat. Impose these industry-wide limits. Change the way that they're marketing these products. Yeah, so explain – because the moment this presentation is over at Michael Moss, you get a sense that there was this kind of silence, the sense of it being really, really awkward. And I guess James Behnke, Michael Mudd kind of bracing themselves for what would happen next.
Yes. And what happened next, there was this silence, and up stood, and this is according to three, four people who were at the meeting, because I certainly wasn't as a reporter. Reporters weren't invited to this meeting.
Of course.
Up stood before them one of the most powerful people in the industry. His name was Steve Sanger. He was the CEO of General Mills. And he was important to this group in part because he had had and was having such a stunningly successful year. He had managed to bring General Mills up par with Kellogg and even pass it, and by some measure, in the cereal aisle. He was creating new hand-to-mouth convenience products that were wowing the industry. Go-Gurt was just one of his recent creations, and it was on the way to becoming a new bestseller. That's the sweetened yogurt that's in a tube that kids can open up and hold in one hand as they're doing other activities, what nutrition advocates call sort of mindless eating. And the rest of the industry was looking towards Sanger with some considerable envy. And he got up sort of visibly upset by Mudd's presentation. And what really upset him was kind of this notion that the industry wasn't already doing enough by consumers. And he pointed out, look, you know, we already offer alternatives to people. We give them choices. If they want low-fat this, we've got low-fat versions of our products. If they want low-sugar this, we've got a low-sugar version of our products. We are responsible both to consumers and our shareholders. But then he also makes the point that, look, and a lot of these consumers, when it comes down to the decision of buying things, they go for taste. And you can't stand before me and suggest that we do anything but make products that taste really, really good. And then he sat down and that just sort of took the entire energy out of this meeting. Not everybody else, not all the other CEOs agreed with him because they're all kind of positioning themselves differently in the grocery store. And for some of them, it may have been easier to do some of the things Michael Mudd was suggesting. But Sanger spoke with so much force and power that essentially the meeting was over. They had a nice dinner where they had small talk, and then they went back to their companies and basically proceeded with what they had been doing before, which was, you know, continuing their deep, heavy reliance on salt, sugar, fat, especially as the holy trinity on which they, the processed food industry, survives and depends on.
Talk about how instead of pulling back, in fact, they moved forward into this era that really brought us the triple-double Oreo, the banana split cream Oreo. And we'll talk about the Oreo as an example of how this competition really plays out, because that's one of the critical parts of the story here, of course. But you say in the book also 1999 was an important opportunity that was missed, because you say this was a time when we as consumers trusted more than we doubted.
Yeah. I mean, this was a time when you know, when the slow food movement, as it perhaps exists today, was just the figment of the imagination of people, and slow food was a bad thing, and as in slow service at the restaurant. This was a time, you know, I think that when we did inherently trust in, you can still sort of see that today. I mean, you walk into the grocery store, and I think that at least subliminally, there is a basic trust that we have of the grocery manufacturers. We're not walking into a fast food restaurant, we think. Right. We think we're walking into a grocery store and have every expectation that, look, while there may be soda and chips and what have you, but the basic food you're going to get there is designed to make you stronger and healthier. And increasingly, I have certainly found, and certainly since the book came out, people are increasingly concerned about what they're putting into their bodies and increasingly angry at the processed food industry for not working harder to develop truly healthier alternatives and products.
You say that James Bankey and some of the other food scientists who had put this meeting together in 1999, that at first they didn't really blame themselves for the problem. You say that they took comfort in knowing that the food that they had developed was created in, I guess, kind of in a more innocent era, where soda and chips and TV dinners, you say, were kind of intended as occasional fare. And I wanted to have you break that down for us. So the idea was that this food was intended as a snack, whereas the perspective changed because the industry decided we want people snacking all the time, not occasionally. Yeah. Did I get that right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, first the officials. So this wasn't easy for them to talk to me. Yeah. These were not your ordinary whistleblowers that are picking up the phone and calling a reporter saying, hey, have I got a story for you? They talked to me because I came across a trove of internal company documents that put me and the reader at the table as the largest food companies are planning, plotting, formulating their way to engineering new products. And the overriding theme in these documents is that they're not just trying to get us to like their products, they're trying to get us to want more and more of them. And those documents are what helped me convince these top scientists and marketing people to talk to me. And in many cases, they had spent their whole lives developing these products. And so we're on one level defensive. And one of their defenses was, look, you know, we invented this chip or this soda or this sweet tomato sauce, you know, back in the, you know, 70s or what have you, when the American dependence on convenience foods was less. And we intended these to be as, you know, an occasional snack, not an every hour indulgence.
Yeah.
And seemingly overnight in the 80s, early 80s, as some experts have explained to me and view it, it became socially acceptable to eat anything, anywhere, anytime. And that's when you started to see people walking down the street, eating and drinking and bringing food into business meetings. And that played right into the hands of the processed food industry, and especially the snack food arm of the processed food industry, and played right into the hands of what nutritionists call sort of mindless eating, where you're going from hand to mouth and you're cutting the body's natural breaks out of the equation that would normally say to you, hey, I'm getting enough here. Slow down. Move on to something else. That's not coming into play. And that's one of the huge kind of overriding factors. So that these same scientists and marketing people who spent their whole careers designing these products now have had, you know, have come to have considerable regret about what they've done and regret about their inability to have done more while they were still inside the companies to turn things around and steer the industry into a better, healthier direction.
You mention in the book how nutrition science can be, as you put it, notoriously mushy. So you have to be careful about making these connections. Blaming any one single food product for health troubles is problematic. But you mentioned that James Bankey and a lot of these people, they were these food scientists, those that were at that meeting, you say they were pretty candid with you and willing to make more of those connections go further than you were willing to go.
Yeah, I was especially struck by Michael Mudd sort of drawing links to, you know, between foods and bad diets and cancer, which again is much further than I certainly wanted to go. Saturated fat is another issue. There are many people, and there's some pushback on science that links saturated fat to heart disease. The issue, as best as I can tell from talking to the experts, is that it's not salt, sugar, fat per se. It's the amounts that we are intaking these days that are problematic. Yeah. And if you want to deal with saturated fat, it's not just – and to deal with that, it's not just a matter of dialing back on the amount of saturated fat you're consuming, but you need to then replace that with healthier fats. And so much about a healthy diet is much more complex than people commonly sort of perceive it to be. There is no silver bullet here. And likewise, there is no single evil product with which to blame for the situation that we're in.
But it does raise a question that if these industry officials were willing to go that far with you, you know, because you asked this question in the book, what else did they know that they weren't saying publicly?
Yes, that's part of the detective story. And again, that actually made my job as an investigative journalist even harder because I didn't have to prove that these foods are being linked with the obesity crisis. These insiders within these companies had already done that for me and were proceeding within these cabals of concerned insiders were proceeding within their own companies to try to make amends, if you will, you know, already agreeing and conceding the linkages to obesity and other health problems.
Michael Moss is with us. He's an investigative reporter at the New York Times. We're talking about his first book. It's called Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. I'm KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist Michael Moss. We're talking about his new book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. He investigates the food science and corporate scheming that has distorted the American diet and put our health at risk. One of the things you write about, Michael Moss, is this pursuit of allure, which is incredibly sophisticated, and we'll talk about the particulars as we go along. But what's the difference between allure and addictive?
Well, there's no word that the industry hates more than the A word.
Yeah.
But And again, to preface this, look, I'm an investigative reporter. I'm trained to go after the money, and there's $1 trillion a year to go after, and it was very rich. But I found actually one of the most intriguing things was the language that these companies use internally to talk to themselves, because it can be so revealing. While they hate the word addictive, when they're describing the allure of their products, they use words like snackable, craveable. One I heard just the other day from a source was almost the best of all, which is Moore-ishness, as in M-O-R-E-ishness. I mean, these are not English lit majors, mind you. These are food scientists and marketing people talking, you know, not to the public but to themselves to describe the attraction of their products. And there really isn't very much difference. I mean, they will argue that, look, you know, it's hard to call food addictive like it is narcotics. There's certain threshold requirements for, you know, narcotic addiction don't apply to food. And I was pretty empathetic with that until I spent some time with Nora Volkow, the head of the National Institute on Drug Abuse outside of Washington. She's a neuroscientist who has studied both narcotics and highly palatable, sugary, fatty foods in relation to how the brain responds to them. Yeah. And she's convinced that for many of us, the sweetest, fattest foods will trigger patterns of compulsive intake every bit as similar to some narcotics. And goes even further and says, look, for people who are hooked on food that's making them unhealthy, it's even harder to deal with that, because you just can't go cold turkey on food as you can with narcotics. We all need food to survive. So it makes it much harder, people actually, to deal with.
You know, I wondered about if I were to go back to the 1971 or 72 or something and eat an Oreo cookie, would it taste different? Like, would I notice that? I mean, would it have a discernible taste difference? Would it be sweeter or more? The mouthfeel be different in terms of the creamy filling? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think the basic Oreo might be the same. And I had one experience recently. I went to Kellogg to talk to them about their dependence on salt, of all things, and they gave me a rare tour of their secret, you know, research and development lab, and they were making. Well, I should preface this by saying, too, I was a bit of a latchkey kid when I grew up, and one of my favorite snacks after school was the Pop-Tarts.
Yeah.
And they were experimenting, Kellogg, with Pop-Tarts, and they had screwed up, and there was a whole gigantic bin full of mushed-up, wasted Pop-Tart dough. And the aroma wafting through the research development facility brought me back, you know, 40 plus years to where I was a kid in California popping those Pop-Tarts and waiting for them to come out of the toaster. The smell was exactly the same. And you know what they say about smells is there's nothing sort of more stimulating to your memory than a good smell.
Right.
So I think that some of the basic formulations for these foods have stayed the same. Coca-Cola is another one. I don't think that they've really fiddled much with that other than the classic Coke disaster since the beginning. Once they get these formulas engineered perfectly, they're really loath to mess around with them. Now, that said, you know, the basic Oreo, which we can talk about, has morphed into all of what they call these line extensions.
Yeah.
With all kinds of size and flavor and shape permutations that just build on the basic mainline product itself.
Well, it does. I think the Oreo is the great example to talk about one of the difficulties in sort of, you know, mutually disarming these companies is, for example, in 2003, you write about how Oreo started getting competition from Hershey. Hershey started putting these chocolate cookies on the shelf, so they had to be more competitive, so they started adding fat. And this is where we, as I said, got the, what was it, the triple-double Oreo and these different iterations of the basic Oreo.
And this is exactly what Michael Mudd had warned the industry about and argued against, which is the notion that if any one company tries to dial back on their caloric loads individually, competitors will swoop in and try to claim that ground or that space of your stomach as consumers are, you know, are drawn toward the tastier, higher loads. I mean, the Oreo story, though, is even sort of more remarkable because when Michael Mudd failed to enlist the entire industry, he went back to Kraft, which was the largest food company at the time, and managed to convince the CEO, the heads of Kraft, to initiate an anti-obesity program. And it was extraordinary in three different ways. First, they looked at their marketing to kids and decided to cut back on the marketing of the most sugary products they had to kids during the Saturday morning cartoon hours because they realized, as people have known for a long time, which is that kids cannot distinguish between advertising and reality. Yeah. You know, when that cartoon character gets up and says, you know, eat this sugary cereal, they think that's the truth and the facts, and they're not seeing that as an advertising ploy like adults will. Then they looked at their packaging and descriptions on the packages and decided they were being less than honest with people. They were you know, especially concerned about their snacks that had two or three or more servings per package because their own data would show that many of us will not just stop at one serving. We'll eat the whole thing.
Of course.
And yet they were putting on the label the calorie amounts only for one of those little tiny servings. And so anybody really wanting to know how much they were consuming had to do the math for themselves. They decided that was being deceptive. And so Kraft on its own, aside from the industry, aside from any government regulation, began printing two sets of nutrition information, one per serving and one for the entire package. They were telling people how much is in this entire bag, you know, beyond the little serving. And then thirdly, they went to their scientists and said to them, and this was the most astounding thing of all, said to them, look, we know all your lives you've been driving toward the optimum allure, using as much salt, sugar, and fat as you wanted to. No more. We are going to put a cap, category by category by category, of how much salt, sugar, and fat you can add to these products to make them craveable. And that was just sort of astonishing. And they did it. And look, I mean, it had some success. It had some failures. I mean, one of the biggest obstacles for Kraft, a large portion of its revenue is cheese. I mean, it just can't make a low-fat, low-salt cheese that tastes, you know, anything close to the real thing. But they did have some success across the board until, especially in the cookie aisle, this battle over cookies came up with its competitor that came in with a fatter cookie. Kraft tried to resist. It tried to maintain the line on the Oreos. It used, you know, a richer cocoa that wasn't necessarily fatter, and then ultimately had to budge a bit. And that's where you saw this emergence of this incredible new lineup of Oreo cookies that are bigger and richer and more enticing than the original Oreo.
You write about in the book how one of the most unsettling parts of the story for you was just how industry alters the physical shape and the structure of salt, sugar, and fat.
It's especially telling with salt, which I always envisioned as a rock dug out of the ground, chopped up and sprinkled onto your food.
Right.
Well, it turns out that I learned after visiting Cargill and some of the other large salt manufacturers that they make as many as 40 different types of salt if you include all the additives and the package sizing. Everything from a very finely powdered salt for the manufacturers of soups because it blends so easily with the liquid, to one of my favorites, a kosher type salt that's shaped as a pyramid, hollowed out on the inside so it dissolves much faster in your saliva and provides what the industry calls a greater flavor burst in sending those signals to the pleasure center of the brain, which is basically, I love this, Michael, eat more.
Right. I wanted to ask you about flavor burst. That's what that salt thing is about, right? I mean,
that's the expression.
That's the expression, yeah.
Yes, for salt, because often salt is on the outside of the food. It's the first thing that hits the tongue, and it really is like, I mean, it's just like a pizzazz, just like a burst that goes. I mean, just you're talking a split second to hit your brain. Mm.
Bliss point is interesting. This is where these intricate charts that get to a bliss point for sugar. Explain that, if you would.
I met and spent time with a legend in the industry named Howard Moskowitz. He was trained in high math at Queens College and then experimental psychology at Harvard. He actually helped coin the term bliss point as it applies to food. And he walked me through his recent creation of a new flavor soda for Dr. Pepper. And to arrive at a product that was guaranteed to be a financial hit for the company, he started with 61 different formulas of sweetness, each just slightly varying from the other, subjected those to more than 3,000 consumer taste tests around the country. Then he took all the data and threw it in the computer and did his high math regression analysis thing. And out came the precise formula that was guaranteed to send us over the moon, which is what he calls the bliss point. Not too much, not too little sugar. And interestingly enough, when you plot that data out on a chart, it's not just a straight line going up. Our liking for sugar is not infinite. Any of your listeners who like sugar in their coffee can do the experiment. Just add sugar till you get to the point that you really like it and keep adding more, and pretty soon you'll get to the yuck point.
Right.
When you plot that data on a chart, it looks like a bell-shaped curve like they use for grading kids in school. And at the very top of that curve is the optimum amount known as the bliss point.
Mm. You say there's a principle that has been held sacred in among these companies, that any improvement to nutrition must not in any way diminish the allure of the food. Is that still a principle that's in place that seems to be holding fast?
Absolutely. That is the bottom line for these companies, whether it's the CEO or the food scientist. You know, they know that ultimately the test of any product is whether people will buy it and like it. And so that's why they put so much energy into not just designing a food, but subjecting it to consumer taste tests. And one of the real quandaries for the industry is, will people give up any smidgen of taste for better health? Can you take a potato chip or, you know, a prepared lunch product or a tomato sauce, you know, and put on the front of the package, you know, this is healthier for you, but it may not taste quite as alluring as the fully loaded version. Can you do that, and will people buy it? Will they put their mouth behind their wanting to eat healthier? And that's a real serious question for the industry. So far, the industry is saying no.
Right.
People will not, by and large, give up any amount of taste for better health.
One of the things a good part of the book you talk about, as we have been to some degree, marketing, which, as you say, is a full partner in this story. You say that I wanted to talk about Oscar Mayer's product called Lunchables, which you write about, because you say the real popularity here, at least at first, for Lunchables wasn't, in fact, the taste, not for kids, but the way it was marketed was that it was empowering for them, that they could be independent in having a Lunchable.
Right. I mean, the Lunchable started out, you know, being everything about the food. It was a solution to the problem at Oscar Mayer, which is that people were eating less meat back in the 80s, concerned about saturated fat and salt. Oscar Mayer, wanting to maintain its production, save jobs, went to its smartest people and said, hey, guys, can you come up with a different way of presenting our meat products rather than just slices in a package? They spent months and months and months studying things that worked out in the consumer marketplace and came up with this idea of repackaging that meat into these TV dinner type trays with little compartments. And the first Lunchable had a little bit of bologna, a little bit of cheese cut up in little slices. And because they couldn't use bread because it wouldn't last on the shelf for the weeks and weeks and weeks that processed foods need to last on the shelf, they used crackers. And they were shocked by how appealing these things really were. They took off like a rocket, sold more than $200 million in sales the first year, which is just astounding. I mean, that is that's the equivalent of a few Grand Slams all in one in the food industry. And one of the things they eventually realized – well, let me say, so then they went on and they created a, you know, a cold pizza Lunchable, a cold hot dog Lunchable, hamburger Lunchable, the maxed out Lunchable, which would max you out on your daily nutritional loads for all of the significant, you know, salt, sugar, fat calories and the well, not calories, but the salt, sugar, fat.
Yeah.
And eventually, though, they realized that, you know, when kids, who they began marketing the Lunchables to, when kids took these into the lunchroom, it really wasn't about the taste. Because, look, frankly, these are not the utmost best-tasting things. It was about the feel, the process of kind of putting the Lunchables together and the what they call the badge value. It gave you incredible street cred with your friends when you walk into a lunchroom with a Lunchables. And so they came up with the slogan, all day you got to do what they say, but lunchtime is all yours. The Lunchables were about empowerment to kids. And Oscar Mayer and then Kraft, which merged with the company, just went to town with that.
You write about also what the food industry has learned from the tobacco industry. You talk about how the tobacco industry, when they opened their records, when they were opened during these, you know, settlement processes that they were having with various states, that they actually, you say, provided a kind of guide to these food giants throughout their most critical moments, you say. It was a guide for them that used that process.
Yeah. So Philip Morris, the largest food company largest tobacco company in the world, became the largest food manufacturer in the world by in the 80s, first by buying the old company General Foods and then Kraft and merging them. And through the 80s and 90s, looking at the documents, interviewing the people I did, including a former CEO, Philip Morris, you can see the tobacco executives doing what you would expect them to do. They are conveying their genius in selling a consumer product to their food people, encouraging them, cajoling them, in some cases, you know, lending them their marketing skill. This was especially apparent in corner stores in marketing snack foods, especially where Philip Morris had great relations with the corner store owners. And then really starting the late 90s, early 2000s, there's a complete sort of change of scene. The states have sued the tobacco industry. Federal regulation is looming. The public polling is going against the tobacco companies. Philip Morris breaks from the industry, becomes the first tobacco company to endorse regulation as a means of sort of staving off a complete disaster. And when they did that, the former CEO explained to me, they turned to their food division people and said, hey guys, you are going to face as great, if not a greater problem with salt, sugar, fat, obesity as we are now with nicotine. And you've got to do something to lessen your dependency. This was 14 years ago. Internally, Philip Morris saying to its Kraft food division people.
Michael Moss is with us. This book is called Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with reporter Michael Moss. We're talking about his book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Let's take some calls. Joy Lynn is with us in Salt Lake. Joy Lynn, welcome.
Thank you. I'm actually a professor of anthropology at Utah Valley University down in Orem, and I specialize in food studies, and I haven't gotten a chance to read Mr. Moss's book yet. It's on my summer list, but I was really struck by something that he said earlier in the program about this cultural change of it becoming okay to eat anytime, anywhere. And as an athlete, I'm really struck by how this bleeds over into sports nutrition, which is what my current research is on. So this whole presentation of excess sugar and excess calories and excess salt and fat and even caffeine as being good and healthy for you in that context. So I see people that, you know, are out on the trails and maybe in the gym, which is a healthy thing to do, but they've maybe worked off a stick, you know, the equivalent of a stick of gum, and they're having a 32-ounce Gatorade and a couple of protein bars or a couple of Clif bars or a gallon of chocolate milk. And I just wonder if you could speak to that context as well, because I see the same thing bleeding over now into athletics.
Yeah, I sort of see that coming more from the industry, though, as a marketing strategy to make up for declining soda sales. And in fact, if you look at the numbers, we've almost made up for that decline, or rather our ability to drink less soda, you know, by drinking more, you know, sugary chocolate milk and sweetened teas and this profusion, as you say, of these sort of power aids that are sweetened and intending to supposedly help our physical fitness regime, even though most people say that they're probably only useful to elite athletes. So I think it's sort of a combination of things going on there too. But you do make an important point, which is that, you know, there is no silver bullet here. Exercise, I mean, hats off to Michelle Obama for keeping the, you know, getting the food conversation going and focusing at least in part on exercise, but it's not going to solve the problem for most people because you have to work out so hard to burn so few calories.
Joy Lynn, thanks. Nicole is with us in Ogden. Nicole, hi.
Hi, Doug. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. You know, it's interesting as I've been listening to this program, different things have struck me that are kind of alarming. What you said a few minutes ago about Philip Morris taking over one of the largest or the largest food manufacturer. When you think about nicotine, there's obviously in cigarettes, the addictive qualities are there. And at the beginning of the show, when we were talking about allure versus addictive, addictive to me sounds sneaky. Allure sounds sexy, you know, or appetizing or whatever. Specifically, I called about Diet Dr. Pepper. Okay, that's my thing.
Okay.
And I know. Yeah. Well, I grew up in a home where my parents only drank Diet Coke. So we never had regular soda around. But everybody had weight problems. And as an adult, you know, I still don't drink regular soda. I drink diet soda, and everyone has their own favorite. But when I've gone off of it, I've noticed that it's not the caffeine that's so much addictive as the aspartame or whatever artificial flavoring.
Which sort of gets to the question of how artificial sweeteners fit into all of this?
Yeah. Have you studied that, artificial sweeteners?
I didn't look at artificial sweeteners except kind of in the context of the kind of migration of sweetness around the grocery store. I mean, it used to be ice cream and, you know, and candy was where you would find sugar in the store. And now so many things are sweet. Bread, yogurt, pasta, you know, tomato sauce. There are some pasta sauces that have as much of sugar as a couple of Oreo cookies in a tiny little serving. And that's totally alarming to nutritionists because what it's doing is it's teaching kids especially to expect sweetness in everything they eat and to forget about bitter or sour or all of the other sort of basic tastes, if you will. The other thing about diet soda, too, is that the science is really out on whether that really helps you maintain or even lose weight. I mean, logically, you would think, well, yeah, it does because I'm imbibing fewer calories. But I think there's a sense that in some people, it may serve as a prophylactic and get you to lower your guard and think that, okay, I've done that. Now I can indulge in that 800-calorie muffin or those extra cookies. And, of course, if you do so, then you've wiped out whatever gain you've had in the diet soda. And then, you know, thirdly, I have heard from people who drink lots of diet soda who say that when they stop, they feel so much better. So something potentially seems to be going on with that. And I think at a minimum, nobody should expect that just, you know, switching to a diet soda is going to solve a weight problem for you. Mm.
James Behnke told you at some point that he said we're hooked on inexpensive food like we're hooked on cheap energy. And he says the question is about, you know, this growing disparity of income between the haves and the have-nots. And you tell this story, which you describe as this kind of heartbreaking moment where you went to this neighborhood in Philadelphia, Strawberry Mansion, where some parents there were really doing their best to try to, you know, make an effort to get their kids to eat better food, healthier food. And you describe this moment when one of the parents was struggling to get her kid to, you know, eat a decent breakfast. And she runs off into a market and she comes up back with this breakfast bar, something she figured was healthy because it said it was. But that was kind of – you said it was a heartbreaking moment for you because it gave you some kind of revelation about that?
Yeah, there are two things there. You know, one is that, you know, home economics has fallen by the wayside. Girls and boys used to be taught in school how to shop, how to cook, how to think about nutrition and be smart on nutrition. You know, and nowadays kids don't know what a calorie is. They don't know what nutrition limits are, guidelines. So it's really hard for them to make judgments and for their parents to make judgments. And I, you know, I have learned after researching this book that while it's important to look at the fine print nutrition facts box on a product, it can also be really important to look at the front of the label because that's where the touting comes, the come-ons, the bragging, the pointing to additives in foods in big splashy letters that could cause you to forget about the rest of the stuff in the food. So when she came out with those cereal bars, I hesitated, but I couldn't help but, you know, turn to the fine print because on the front of the package, what she was so excited about were the words added calcium,
right.
Big giant letters on the front of these little breakfast bars. But when we turned them over and looked at the fine print, you know, they had as much fat and sugar as cookies. And that was heartbreaking that these people were so well-meaning within their very limited economic resources of trying to do better by their children, you know, still lacked the sort of, you know, the educational informational tools to make the best decisions about what to buy and that would help them get in and out of their store with their health intact.
Mm. You point out in the book, you know, most of us, in many ways, we can't stop eating processed foods. And so the question comes up, how do you resist? And you take that up a bit in the book. I mean, you write about this experiment taking place in Philadelphia. Michael Lowe, a professor of clinical psychology at Drexel University, talk a little bit about that program because you say people are reorienting themselves in some ways to processed food.
Yeah, I mean, he has been fighting and looking for a cure to or obesity and ways to control weight for 20, 25 years. He was basically throwing up his hand saying, look, I can get people to lose weight on a diet, but I can't get them to maintain that lower weight level on that diet for all kinds of reasons. And he recently began an experiment where he took people, adults, and put them through just the ringer in completely reorienting them to food. And so they would go shopping now and, for example, look for alternatives. If they felt they couldn't resist ice cream and just eat, you know, one serving, they would buy similar but much lower and much enticing products, like a yogurt. And then they would bring those foods home and they would repackage them themselves into serving sizes in hopes that sort of that act would act as an inhibition to them. So they would stop at that single serving within their cabinets. And then they would get together every week and kind of talk about their successes. And over months and months and months of time and orienting themselves, they were having tremendous success. And I think that was a very sort of compelling thing. I know in my own household, I have two boys, 8 and 13. My wife, Eve, works outside of the home. There's no way we're going to be able to abandon our dependence on processed foods. And I'm hoping – what I'm hoping this book, though, is it's empowering in a way that will help us control those foods rather than letting them control us.
Mm. Because you say in the book, you know, we can only save ourselves. We can only save us. It has to be, you know, you can focus on the on government, which you talk about in the book we didn't get to, you know, regulation. You talk about the industry itself. But I guess that's an important point. We can only save us.
Yeah. And ultimately, I think for meaningful change to happen, consumers are going to have to get louder about their demands for healthier food and their concerns about what we put in our bodies. In the meantime, though, you know, walking into the grocery store, I mean, we're the ones who decide what to buy and how much to eat. And that can be a position of power. And there are some tricks you can use. I mean, look, you walk through the door, they're trying to do everything they can to get you to make a spontaneous decision. Right. So the old adage, make a list and stick to it. The outer margins of the store are where the better food is, the fresh fruits and vegetables. So if you can spend more time there, you're going to be better off. And then when you get to the center part of the aisles, their research shows that your eye goes to the middle part of the aisle at eye level, and that's where they put the products most loaded with salt, sugar, and fat. And so another adage, look low, look high for those healthier versions of those products because they don't sell as well, but they're often there if you take the time to look for them.
About 30 seconds left. You say we're kind of at a tipping point or approaching one anyway.
I think we are. I think there are federal regulators itching to do something here, but they're timid. I think there are companies wanting to do something here. I don't think they're evil and intentionally. I think they will sell us healthy products if they can make money. Yeah. Consumers are becoming more active. The real 800-pound gorilla is Wall Street, which is putting pressure on these companies to produce revenue. But yes, I really feel all the feedback I've gotten to the book that we're at a tipping point and things could really change moving forward.
It's Michael Moss. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter at the New York Times. This is his first book. It's called Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. He joined us from a studio in New York City. Michael Moss, thank you very much for the time.
Doug, it's been a pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.